Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 16, 2020. Sudan forgives rebel leaders.
We need justice to prevail in this country. No one should take what is not his. We need our citizens to enjoy their country. Every citizen has a right in this country and should not be denied. This is one of my best celebrations, which I have been longing to see since 1998.
And a U.S.-based research group says gold from South Sudan is dirty.
That gold is tainted. It has human blood on it. It has a tag of human rights abuses on it.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in Khartoum have offered amnesty to all groups that took up arms against the government. The head of the Sudan Sovereign Council announced the amnesty offer on Thursday. The amnesty does not include suspects with war crime charges. Leaders of various armed groups who attended a peace celebration in Khartoum over the weekend say their arrival in the capital marks an end to war. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Thousands of Sudanese citizens chanted "Welcome to Peace" as they beat drums and dance at Khartoum's Freedom Yard to welcome the opposition leaders. The amnesty signed on Thursday by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, head of Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council, excludes those with arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Court or those wanted for genocide or crimes against humanity committed in Darfur and other parts of Sudan. Addressing the peace celebrations, Mini Arko Minawi, head of the Sudan Liberation Army, says he is in Khartoum to work with the transitional government as a joint team to implement the peace agreement and wiped out marginalization from all regions of the country. We must work to assume responsibility and leave our political differences so as to achieve democracy in our country, said Minawi. Minawi says the presence of armed opposition leaders in Khartoum marks the end of war in Sudan and a shift in focus on developing the country's economy. At the same event, Muhammad Hamdan Dagalo, deputy head of the Sovereign Council, welcomed the armed opposition leaders in Khartoum, calling them brothers in peace. Dagalo promised to work hand in hand with armed groups to build what he calls the new Sudan.
In the Sudan,
as we begin this era in our beloved country, we need to unite our efforts to build it up more than any other time past. Let's come together and speak one language and begin to rebuild the security and stability of this beautiful country.
For the 43-year-old Zahra Adam, who hails from South Kordofan State, sings a song of peace for Sudan with tears in her eyes. She says the government should bring on board all holdout groups, including Abdulaziz Al-Hilu.
As we speak, a tribal conflict is still going on in my area, and I am deeply concerned about this. I want our government to reach out and save our young people in South Kordofan and in Abu Korshola locality. We cannot continue to take revenge on each other. Every day people are being killed.
34-year-old Abdul Muhammad Juma, who hails from northern Darfur state, says Sudan can never achieve lasting peace without arresting suspects accused of committing war crimes in Darfur. Juma says the country's wealth must be distributed equitably and the marginalization of certain communities must end.
We need justice to prevail in this country. No one should take what is not his. We need our citizens to enjoy their country. Every citizen has a right in this country and should not be denied. This is one of my best celebrations, which I have been longing to see since 1998.
Many citizens here in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, remain optimistic about the peace, but called on the transitional government to work harder on institutional reforms and to build the country's economy. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit, in Khartoum.
A U.S.-based research organization, The Sentry, released a report last week warning the international community that gold coming from South Sudan, Sudan, Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo are mined under difficult conditions. One co-author of the report says human rights abuses are common in countries where conflict gold is produced. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The Sentry report highlights the connection between illegal gold mining and human rights violations, such as the recruitment of child soldiers and forced labor. Brian Adeba, who co-authored the report, says the release is aimed at informing the world that the business of gold mining from South Sudan and other African countries contributes to human rights abuses and continues to fuel armed conflict and corruption.
That gold is tainted. It has human blood on it. It has a tag of human rights abuses on it. And therefore, if you purchase that gold from Sudan, from South Sudan, and from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and from Central African Republic, you're potentially contributing to fueling the conflict.
In South Sudan, the report documented how the National Salvation Front, a rebel movement fighting President Salva Kiir's government, and the SPLM-IO, a former rebel group, are participating in the illicit and very lucrative exploitation of gold. Both NAS and SPLM-IO officials deny their groups are involved in the illicit gold mining business. Colonel Lampaul Gabriel, deputy spokesperson of the SPLM-IO, says if any gold mining is taking place, it is practiced by individuals but not the party.
We need to differentiate between the movement and individuals. We know the individual works for the movement, but now the movement, if the movement did not authorize you to do something and it did something on your own, it is not the movement that is responsible. We will investigate.
So Ba Samuel is a spokesperson for the National Salvation Front.
If you are involved in this thing, then I think it could have gone smoothly. So we are not involved in this. First of all, as the rebels, where do you sell this gold? And then number two, where are the equipment for the extraction of gold that you can be able to get it in large quantity and sell it out and finance the war? You know how expensive financing war it is.
A report released last year by a UN panel of experts detailed the existence of gold mining activities by NAS and SPLM-IO in several areas of Central Equatorial State, including Gorom, the Luri River Basin west of Juba, Lobonok, Morobo, Wonduruba, and rivers and streams around Kajokeji. The Sentry's report says once extracted, the gold is covertly moved across borders. James Okuk, a senior research fellow and political analyst at the Juba-based Center for Strategic Policy Studies, warns that unless illicit gold mining is brought to an end, the practice will hurt South Sudan's future economic prospects.
Even signing an agreement and then their needs are not fulfilled, they will still continue doing the same business of survival.
Adeba says governments like South Sudan have an obligation to stop the illicit business and stop human rights abuses.
The way to do that is to ensure that the conflict actually stops and mechanisms are put in place to ensure that the mining of gold is free from things like child labor, human rights abuses, forced conscription of children into armed forces, and then a certification process will ensue where the gold is certified as having complied with international standards in its production.
The report also recommends the UAE government address regulatory loopholes by requiring proof of payment for imported gold, requiring all gold refineries with a presence in the UAE to undergo independent audits, and banning cash transactions for gold above small amounts. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
28 South Sudanese students stranded in Zimbabwe after graduating from various universities in July this year, have returned home. The students occupied South Sudan's embassy premises in Harare in August, shutting down its operation to protest what they called dire living conditions and the government's delay to pay students' stipends since 2018. Some of the students who arrived in Juba say they feel relieved to finally be back. For VOA News, David Monodanga reports from Juba.
The students occupied the South Sudanese embassy premises in the Zimbabwean capital Harare in August, shutting down its operations to protest what they called dire living conditions and the government's failure to pay students' stipends since 2018. The first group of students to return from Zimbabwe arrived at Juba International Airport on November 1st. John Mabil, who graduated with a law degree from Zimbabwe's Midland State University in July, says life was tough in Zimbabwe.
We do not get any assistance from anywhere because, you know, Zimbabwe is a part of a country which we do not usually have our relatives or any family member or friend who could give us an assistance. So we were in a dire situation of coming home.
A majority of the returning students have traveled to their villages and hometowns to be with family and loved ones. Mabil says he was not able to travel to his hometown of Bor because he has to make sure the government writes to the Zimbabwean government requesting that officials there instruct the universities to release the 28 students' academic certificates and transcripts. Mabil says he and his colleagues have been meeting with Foreign Affairs Ministry officials and Abdel Baghi, the vice president in charge of the service cluster, to ensure that the government writes to Zimbabwe.
That letter is underway going to Zimbabwe, and as soon as it reaches, they are actually very positive that our results are going to be released. The content of the letter is instructing the government of Zimbabwe to release our documents. The letter is acting as a security in case the government of South Sudan fails to fulfill its obligation, then they will have to take some legal measures.
Mabil is also calling on the South Sudan government to clear the arrears it owes Zimbabwean universities so that students can receive their certificates and return home. South Sudanese Liberio Yanga graduated with a degree in tourism from Zimbabwe's Midland State University. He says he is glad to be back home and hopes to contribute to developing the country's tourism sector, which he says is lagging behind other countries on the continent.
For the tourists to come, they need a nice place, a nice road, all the development. For someone to come, like they will see everything, something that can attract them, something that can motivate them to come. When those things that motivate them to come, they're not there. So many tourists, they will not come.
In an earlier interview with South Sudan in Focus, Charles Lotara, a South Sudanese who graduated from the Great Zimbabwe University last year, said more 170 students who graduated from six different Zimbabwean state universities over the past 5 years have not received their certificates and transcripts because the South Sudan government has yet to clear its areas in those universities. Lotara said the government is losing skilled human resources when it ignores its commitment to pay students' fees on government scholarships.
These students who are roaming the streets, these are students who can still be good human resources to the country. These are students who need to be taken seriously. They can make positive contributions to the development of the country. The government should not relax. The government must stand up and shoulder its responsibility. Of course, we have been through COVID-19, but even before COVID-19, this challenge was already there, but no one even thought of addressing it.
About a dozen other South Sudanese students who have been studying on government scholarships in Cuba have been stuck there with no money for food, transportation, or other basic needs. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the rate of COVID-19 infections shoots up in the United States. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? people speak out on important questions. The question today:
who comes first in your life?
My sister comes first because she was the one who raised me. She taught me how to do everything, so she'll come first.
Definitely God, but I think when talking about people, I think my family and my friends, just people who I've, you know, surrounded myself with.
I think the woman that I love, every moment I think about her, every moment I wish I'm around her, because she makes me happy. She gives me a lot of peace. She has a way of helping me to just relax and calm down.
My mom comes first in my life because she has really done a whole lot for me, and if there's anything, I would really want to do something to honor her.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. When President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in on January 20th, if health experts' projections should hold, he will face likelihood of even more coronavirus deaths and hospitalization. The U.S. has recorded more than 10.8 million confirmed COVID-19 cases and over 245,000 deaths. AP correspondent Sally Ada reports.
We really are in a critical situation.
Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary Admiral Brett Giroir, after a record 180,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported Saturday.
You must physically distance. When you cannot physically distance, everybody needs to wear a mask in public spaces. That's absolutely critically important. They do work.
Joining Giroir on ABC's This Week, Dr. Atul Gawande, a Harvard surgeon who was on President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 advisory board.
Opposing masks is like opposing washing hands. It's not political. We can pull together. We can do this.
I'm Shelley Adler.
Still in U.S., the work to put together a new President-elect Joe Biden's work to assemble his administration remain in political limbo following a weekend that saw thousands of President Donald Trump's supporters converging on the nation's capital to show echo his unverified claims of election fraud. Biden has been huddling with advisers as he puts his team together ahead of his January 20 swearing-in. Meanwhile, it appears on Sunday that Trump had for the first time in a tweet acknowledged Biden's win. But as AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports, that was not the case.
Trump did not use Biden's name, but says he won, at the same time making clear he's not conceding and will keep trying to overturn the election result. The Sunday morning tweets included several baseless claims about the November 3rd vote, calling it rigged and only a victory for Biden in the eyes of the media. However, state and federal officials say the election was safe and secure. On ABC's This Week, Trump's former national security adviser John Bolton called on Republicans to speak up.
If the Republican voters are only hearing Donald Trump's misrepresentations, it's not surprising that they believe it. It's critical for other Republican leaders to stand up and explain what actually happened.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
From U.S., we move to Ethiopia, where security analysts are raising alarms as Ethiopia's military action against the Tigray region is spreading beyond the country's borders and threatening stability in the region. Tigray regional president over the weekend said his fighters have been battling Eritrean forces after targeting Ethiopia's neighbor with missile strikes. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Sunday his country can deal with the armed uprising on their own, but has also withdrawn thousands of Ethiopian troops battling jihadists in Somalia to help in the Tigray conflict. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Ethiopian government forces have captured the town of Alamata, 120 kilometers from the Tigray region's capital, Mekele. After nearly 2 weeks of fighting, Mustafa Ali is a Horn of Africa security expert. Despite the capture of Alamata, he says the federal government is facing a long conflict.
This tells you that Ethiopia is advancing and is going to capture more ground. But here is the challenge. This war might turn to become a major drawn-out guerrilla fighting that will be very hard for the Ethiopian soldiers to dislodge the TPLF.
Ethiopia's military attacked fighters loyal to the Tigray regional government this month after Tigrayan forces allegedly assaulted a military base. The war has already sent more than 20,000 civilians to flee to Sudan for safety, a sign of the region's worsening humanitarian situation. The war escalated in recent days. Tigray's regional president, Debretsion Gebremichael, said his forces attacked Eritrea with missiles and warned there will be more attacks. Tigray accuses Eritrea of sending troops to attack them, an allegation denied by Eritrea. Ali says the involvement of Eritrea will strengthen the Ethiopian government's chances of winning the war.
The war is going to be more deadly and there will be a lot more refugees coming out of the conflict itself. The entry of Eritrea will give Abiy Ahmed an upper hand in that he will be able to use the Eritrean forces, their expertise, and understanding of the terrain, basically, because all these are Tigrayans.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Sunday his forces can handle the fighting and don't need assistance from another country. In recent days, the Ethiopian government has pulled some troops from Somalia to help quell the armed uprising. That move may have a negative impact on Somalia, says Comfort Ero, the Africa Program Director for the International Crisis Group.
This also sort of puts Somalia into jeopardy, especially as Somalia gets ready for presidential and parliamentary elections. And as you know, there is a very close relationship between Prime Minister Abiy and President Farmaajo. The most worrying concern would be what this would mean for Sudan, given its own very fragile stability at the moment, and then Somalia as it enters into election.
Thomas Murphy, the Sub-Saharan Africa Intelligence Analyst for the Risk Advisory Group, says the conflict will also stretch Ethiopia's internal security apparatus.
There's widespread bouts of intercommunal violence going on across the Amhara region, across the Oromo region, and across the Somali and Southern Peoples regions. And the army is quite often having to deploy to contain that, in particular in situations where local security forces are unable to do so. The fact that the federal government is now involved in this conflict against the Tigray region is only going to stretch that capacity further and force Abiy to perhaps make some tough decisions about, you know, deployments in Somalia, whether that be for AMISOM or more broadly.
AMISOM is the African Union mission in Somalia. The United States, the United Nations and other world powers have called for a halt to the fighting and start of mediation efforts, so far to no avail, as the federal government has ruled out any talks with the regional leaders. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally to Malawi, where Malawian self-proclaimed prophet Shepherd Bushiri, who is based in South Africa, has fled to Malawi, violating one of his bail conditions following his arrest in October in South Africa for theft, fraud and money laundering. For VOA News, Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Bushiri and his wife Mary were arrested with two others in October in a multi-million dollar money laundering case, but were granted bail November 4. He preaches in his Enlightened Christian Gathering Church, which has over 70 branches across the world. Among the bail conditions was that they would surrender all travel documents and not leave South Africa. In his televised press conference in Malawi Saturday night, Bushiri said the couple had fled South Africa for security reasons, claiming some people wanted to kill him. He did not specify why.
My safety in South Africa is not okay. I am seeking my safety to be considered, that the government of South Africa should assure me of my safety. I have opened a case. I'm looking forward to have feedback from the government. whether the people have been arrested or anything has been done to the people who wanted to kill me in South Africa.
However, Bushiri did not disclose how he entered Malawi. He said he would only return to South Africa if South African authorities assure him of his safety and that he would not be rearrested for violating bail conditions. South African police say they are investigating how Bushiri escaped the country without travel documents. Police spokesperson Kaskeho Muhale told South African Broadcasting Corporation Saturday that police discovered Bushiri's escape when he failed to report to a police station Friday, as required under the terms of his bail.
We cannot divulge as to what has transpired yesterday since we found out that they did not comply with the bail condition. And it is this part of the investigation that we do not want to reveal.
There was a widespread public speculation in Malawi and South Africa that Bushiri might have fled South Africa with Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera, who was on a two-day official visit to South Africa and returned on Saturday. But Chakwera's press office has vehemently denied this. However, in a tweet Saturday, South African Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, Ronald Lamola, said his government will ask Malawi to have the fugitive extradited. Malawi government spokesperson Gospel Kazako told a South African TV station Saturday evening that Malawi is waiting for a formal South African request to act on the matter.
South African government is our friend. We respect it. And certainly, if they are going to make any contact with us, we are going to respond accordingly. At the moment, there hasn't been any contact, and there is absolutely nothing that we can do about it.
However, Bushiri says he is planning to meet with Malawian authorities Monday to raise his concerns over how he is being treated in South Africa. Gadon Ganchetsela, a law professor at the University of Malawi, has faulted Bushiri for violating his bail conditions set by Pretoria Magistrates Court in South Africa. Ganchetsela has urged Malawi to deal with the matter according to the law to avoid harming diplomatic relations with South Africa. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with the song Barani by Colonel Mido.
Barani dungangwa turonyo, eri si limoro el songangwe, animangi he auru koto sende, wamakwi ya muhe waduhe ngangwa turonyo. Mufunga ni ria he frani arime, muvrani shigani engapaye, wanovwe oguyo, na engapaye kuchirani, kamungwe angafrani batayo, saa sadaya unumutukrani, chikwe gwerapaye, Chipali mungwe gangamwe, natandwe natalimwe, yaye kinzi, amina.
Barani dungwangwa turonywe, barani Dungwangwa turonywe
Esilimono ensongangwe Esilimono ensongangwe Animangi he aurukwato sende Animangi he aurukwato sende Wamapia muhe wadwe mangwa turonywe Ya
Barani Dungwangwa turonywe Barani Dungwangwa turonywe
Esilimono ensongangwe Esilimono ensongangwe
We've been listening to Colonel Mido with the song Barani. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap. Practice social distancing and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
One of
them.
nanga paye
kutra
kamungu yanga frani
ayo
esa asadaya